I'm really privileged to be here at an event that's associated with the late Walter Capps. I mean, he was a great teacher and leader, and I wonder how such a serious scholar of theology might have interpreted a governor of such messianic vision that he actually compared himself last week in his inaugural address to the Apostle Paul. Leonard Wallach, who I also need to thank and was here, she can't be here, but invited me and arranged this evening, wrote me earlier this week to say that the speech had been scheduled perfectly, since it was difficult to tell from some of his recent press clips whether this is a second term or a second coming. I'm here to say that it's a second term and not a second coming, and as well as it started, history and some of the early signs really suggest it's going to be a very difficult term. In fact, it's not at all clear to me that he will last in the job for the whole 4 years. We'll get to that much later. It is remarkable, though, and I was looking at one of his internal polls earlier today. He's back up to nearly 70% approval rating, which is something he hasn't been at since the end of his first year in November of 2004. As we all know, he then decided to try to spend that political capital to push initiatives and a special election and get big changes in education and the budget and political reform in the state. And that didn't work. That height to bottom to height is one of the great stories of American politics. It's nearly impossible politically for someone to get that high, get that low, down below 40% approval, and then get that high again. But that's part of the unique thing about this fellow. We pay much more attention to him than we would a normal politician. We're much more aware of his mistakes. We're much more aware of his successes. And so he's thus going, I think, destined to be, as long as he is in this game, a very volatile stock. And we're likely to see, partly because of that and partly because of how his approach to things, we're going to see a lot of giant ups and downs. But the question that seems very much in people's minds is, what direction is he going to take? There's considerable mystery and debate about his loyalties. I've been talking about this book since it came out in the fall all over the place, and there's this one genre of question I get the most. Is he a closet Democrat? Is he a secret Nazi? Is he, just a cynical opportunist who just wants to win? Can you believe him? Can you trust him? There are many reasons to doubt his word, and there's no reason to doubt his desire for victory. But I do believe there's a sort of guiding philosophy and a belief about right and wrong that is very much a part of him, and which has not changed very much since he went into office. He described himself last week in his inaugural address, which was extraordinary because I'd heard him say the sort of things he said, but never so explicitly in a public setting, where he called himself explicitly centrist and not just a believer in bipartisanship, but a believer in postpartisanship, a world without parties. And to the extent that those terms have any real meaning, I think they're essentially accurate. But they don't really answer the question of what kind of middle this fellow envisions for California. And I think the answer to that question, let's look first at his history. In the Austria of Arnold Schwarzenegger's youth, every institution, even small institutions like clubs and pubs and even gymnasiums, had to affiliate with one of the leading parties, the Reds, the Social Democrats, or the Blacks, the Austrian People's Party. There was very little money in private hands. Institutions often depended on these parties for funding. And in his hometown of Tal, which is just outside Graz, the second largest city in Austria, and I visited there on two different reporting trips in 04 and 05, where I essentially interviewed everyone I could find who had ever met him. The teenage Schwarzenegger seemed to hold opinions in line with the Social Democrats, with the Reds. His longtime schoolmate, Peter Ertl, who's now the mayor of Tal, recalls listening to Schwarzenegger express admiration for Bruno Kreisky, who's the great social democratic foreign minister and social democrat politician of the late 20th century in Austria. He was a guy who had traveled to the United States, he had hung out with the Kennedys, and eventually became chancellor. But his politics changed, and they literally changed because of bodybuilding. There was a Mr. Austria named Kurt Marnell, who recruited Arnold for the new gym he was starting. Arnold had worked out in a gym that was affiliated with the Reds, but some of the other people in the gym didn't like his American-style training methods that he had learned from various muscle magazines. So Arnold opened his own gym, and he got money from the Blacks, from the OVP. So Arnold, to join this gym, had to join the youth club of the Austrian People's Party. He won his first bodybuilding and weightlifting victories on behalf of the Austrian People's Party, on behalf of the Blacks. He essentially pumped iron for Austria's version of the Republicans. And he has been, at least nominally, a Republican ever since. But I think very much to him, and he told me that story, a label that was so sort of lightly bestowed and pragmatically accepted is always a label that was destined to sort of be worn lightly. His friends, his family, his wife, obviously Democrats, so are most of the gubernatorial aides to which he is closest. One of the ironies of 2005, when he was widely being described as having turned to the right, was that inside his own office, the Republican aides were increasingly bitter that he had shut them out. That they were being edged out by a group of friendly aides that were called the Posse. Arnold took members of the Posse to lunch and hung out with him in his downtime, and the Posse are almost entirely Democrats. And having Democratic friends while remaining Republican, that's sort of the essence of Schwarzenegger. This is a person who's always gravitated to people with whom he disagrees, and time again in his life, he sort of crosses borders and associated with groups whose experience seem foreign to his own. He's made sort of a virtue of not belonging. I mean, he's the kind of movie star who is successful in comedy because he seems so out of place in the genre. The action star who would look like he had, you know, reported the wrong set and ended up in a Danny DeVito picture. For this guy, being out of place is the point. I once heard Arnold describe this as the great thing about the nail that sticks up, you know, not that it gets hammered down, but it gets noticed. And when I once asked him, you know, about his philosophy, he said the man whose views had the most lasting influence on him was Helmut Knauer, who was a local anarchist in Graz when he grew up, who he met when Knauer was hanging out with young bodybuilders. And Knauer liked to say outrageous things, and he tried to teach English to Schwarzenegger. Knauer spoke English because he had escaped from the Nazi army and ended up fighting with the English. And he tried to teach Schwarzenegger English by having him read copies of Playboy. That may explain a lot, too. Knauer told him to learn languages and think big, and told him he could be, you know, whatever he wanted to be, which was a, you know, radical notion to Arnold in that day. And he's carried that into politics. He loves the fact that none of us, and people in my profession particularly, you know, we're always struggling to characterize his politics. When Bob White, who was Pete Wilson's chief of staff, came to visit Arnold on the set of End of Days in 1999, this was to try to get Arnold to look at politics, get into politics, and revive the state Republican Party. Arnold immediately said, I have no interest in that, and complained about the party's support for the impeachment of President Clinton. You know, what had Clinton done wrong, Arnold asked. The president was simply doing what men sometimes do, and doing a decent job managing the economy, despite all of the hubbub, Arnold said. Ultimately, the guiding philosophy here is this sort of fierce individual independence, a distrust of labels, and a belief, which is sort of strikingly naive for such a manipulative person, that anyone can do anything. That really is the central Schwarzenegger ideology. Anyone can do anything. So what does that mean when, for a politician who's taking positions and having views on issues? It's often thought that he's changed his views on issues as he's gotten to office. But I found in covering him and also reviewing pretty much everything he's uttered in public, plus, you know, private notes of his, emails, tapes of meetings and other things he's done in his life. He tapes almost everything he's done, videotapes it, has a guy who was his stunt double, follow him around with a video camera. But I found looking at that his views have stayed pretty much the same. A key point is to go back to 2001. That's when he really began thinking seriously about running for governor of California. The idea then was that he might challenge Gray Davis for governor in 2002 when Davis was up for re-election. Schwarzenegger brought on some political consultants. He was talking to Governor Pete Wilson and some of his own friends, the family friends through his mother-in-law, about what a campaign would be like. He was also polling on his political prospects, polling on the prospects of Terminator 3 financially, if he was in it. But as part of the exercise of preparing, a political consultant named Don Sippel, who actually lives just up the road in Montecito, sat down Schwarzenegger in front of a camera. They called this session on the schedule the authenticity interview. And they basically, from off camera, Sippel and a couple other consultants asked a series of straightforward questions of Schwarzenegger about his child, his career, and really his beliefs and views on government and politics. And the idea was to allow Schwarzenegger to speak his mind, to provide a view of the potential candidate that was authentic as possible. Then they could show tape of the authentic Schwarzenegger to focus groups of voters. Those focus groups, could then help the consultants determine which of Schwarzenegger's views were popular and should be highlighted, and which opinions he ought to keep to himself. He began by talking very expansively about his child in Austria, very personal, his process of visualizing goals, his Harley-Davidson motorcycle. He went into a lot of detail in describing his difficulties in getting into show business and how, in his determination to do that, and had to actually be drawn into the discussing the policy issues. He seemed a bit out of touch at times. Although he lived in a huge house in the late neighborhood of Pacific Palisades, he declared that, quote, "What we did with our kids is to bring them up in a very normal setting. Our house is a moderate house. It's not a huge Beverly Hills mansion. We wanted to have it much more normal. Still extraordinary for other people's standards, but for us it's normal." He talked about how he shielded his own children from violent movies. "I say this to Maria always, the children are an empty bucket. And I feel there are many people, different people, who can fill up this bucket, and I want to be the one who fills it up, and she should be the one, rather than other people, rather than MTV, rather than television, movies, or all the other kinds of things, or other kids." He then began to discuss policy more seriously. He was most adamant that the state should be providing, better education, more after-school programs, and most specifically, health insurance for every child, undocumented or documented. He acknowledged as he was talking that he sounded like Hillary Clinton, but declared that he had kind of liked the Clinton health care plan, and he thought every kid earned a chance. He said, quote, "I have learned firsthand that there's no such thing as a bad kid. There's no kid that is born and fills out a paper and says, I want to be a bad kid. I want to kill somebody. I want to rob somebody. I want to steal. I want to lie all the time. That doesn't exist." As the interview continued, Schwarzenegger became more impassioned and populist. Talked about how, "I think in order to be a really good leader, you always have to represent the people, not parties," he said, clearing his throat. To him, the people meant, and I quote, "the consumer, everyone out there, rather than a specific interest group. To me, this is a disastrous situation, the way it has gone in politics, the way certain politicians go in there because they are supported by interest groups. I think the interest groups, it should never be allowed that any interest group participates in the campaign where they contribute money, where the politician takes money from them. Then you have to, you're obligated to help them rather than the people who vote out there, rather than the average American." There's quite a bit more like that. He ended the speech by saying that one of his goals for politics was that he wanted to bring a lot more humor into the world of public affairs. People might not like what he had to say, he said, but he would be sure to entertain them. So they took this tape, split it up into about six pieces, and showed it to four focus groups 2 weeks later in May of 2001. The first one was a group of about 12 registered voters in Encino in the Valley. People really liked, they got a very warm reception when he was talking about his personal dealings, his difficulty breaking into Hollywood. But the two subsequent clips didn't play very well. There was a segment with Schwarzenegger denouncing violence, that he didn't like that. The clip about him saying that his children were raised in a normal lifestyle drew guffaws. And then there was incredible literally head-scratching in the room when he discussed his view that the government should be providing children and documented and undocumented with health insurance. One woman objected immediately about the program covering undocumented immigrants. Several other people said they agreed. Others point out the government already funded the health care of many poor children. But what people really liked was the clip of Schwarzenegger talking in these populist terms about his distaste for interest groups and his dislike of partisanship. Response was just electric. They do these dial tests during these focus groups where they, if you like it, turn it, if you completely like it, you're at 50 is the neutral position. If you dislike it, you turn towards zero. If you like it, you turn towards 100. And for part of it, the screen that displays what the group was doing only goes up to about 90. And at a couple points during this part when he was sort of talking this populist way, the line disappeared above 90. People really liked that. And that's essentially the politician we got. He dropped a lot of the talk about healthcare, about some of his those sorts of views, and we got this sort of populist Avenger. He tried briefly to talk his people into having him sponsor a ballot initiative. He wanted to sponsor a ballot initiative that would provide a funding stream to support health insurance for all children. But his folks tried to essentially successfully talked him out of it. So, you know, that was the guy we got. Now, he kept these centrist views, and in 2003, when he was running for governor, he actually reduced these views to writing. In several pages of policy, there was actually a big binder in the end that he carried around. The campaign never released all of this policy. But much of the environment stuff, including some of the stuff he's done on global warming, were written down in this book at his direction. Some of the views on health care, prescription drugs, all these things are in there. But what was interesting is, and the reason why they didn't release this amount of policy was that polling at the time, their polling, showed that the public actually didn't want a candidate who said he had a lot of plans, you know, a 3 or 5 point plan. They wanted an outsider. We wanted someone who hadn't made up his mind about issues. And the fear was that the public knew how many thoughts Schwarzenegger actually had about policy, how many views he had sort of fought through, they would see him as an insider rather than the outsider that the public seemed to want. He undersold himself. There was another problem with selling him as this big outsider populist Avenger. The populist tough guy image matched his movie image, but it didn't represent the real Arnold, the person who had managed his career. Schwarzenegger has always been someone who's sort of willing to tweak and change and reappraise to, you know, he'll reshoot the movie if the public doesn't like it. He often ended up in the same place on views, but he was a compromiser, again, the guy who's attracted to people who disagreed with him. One point during early on in his time in office, one of his more conservative aides, a fellow, came up to me and said very dismissively of Arnold, you know, the governor's a lover, not a fighter. You know, very angry about this. He always wanted to sort of compromise, and I think a lot of his aides became very wary of showing the public the real Arnold, the guy who often changed his mind so many times and wanted to reach out to people and compromise with people. The idea was that, you know, if the public saw the real Arnold, they might think he was weak, and there was nothing worse and more dangerous for a political strong man, someone with that kind of image, than to be perceived as weak. So he played this initiative warrior part. This worked for a while in 2004. He used the initiative to create deals, as so many of us saw. But really his volatility and his unique management style, where he, you know, hired people from across the political spectrum, but managed essentially by bake-off. He listened to this diametrically different group of views on his staff. I mean, he had a left and a right and a center. I mean, it was almost like a European parliament. He listened to all these different people. And then he, when he was trying to do something, you know, put together a plan, negotiate something, he would be very careful. He would often double or triple or even quadruple book the job. He'd have different aides trying to do the same deal. This created a lot of confusion about what his real intentions were. The legislators never quite understood where he was going. What he thought he was doing was creating a certain internal competition, a way to see, you know, what would be his best option. Fundamentally, it was also a way for him, and still is a way for him, to keep control. No decision could ever be made without him. So it was, you know, there was these great debates, but ultimately, no one was really empowered to do very much. And ultimately, this created a lot of internal tension and led to many of the operational difficulties he had. He had some aides. They disagreed and fought so much internally, they pretty much stopped talking to each other. In 2005, it all broke down. He did the bake-off kind of style in terms of drafting his initiatives. It wasn't clear until very late in the game what the initiatives would be. He didn't really want a special election with the initiatives that were originally on the ballot. The idea was that the initiatives that he qualified with signatures would create pressure on unions and Democratic legislators to create compromise measures, compromise constitutional amendments that would effectively replace those initiatives on the ballot. They would be big reforms. That didn't work, and that failed for three big reasons. One was all these internal problems we had. He had really declared war. He wanted to declare a big push in 2005, but he couldn't get his own people to sign on to the plan. Number two was he was very slow in developing these proposals because of this unique management style where he set people against each other. And the unions were able to, the public employees were able to essentially attack him and his proposals before he actually had all of the details together. He was still trying to put things together, not ready for a fight, and the fight had already begun. He actually announced what he wanted to do, the state of the state, but he did not have his, in January, but he did not have his proposals together until March of 2005, 2 months later. And thirdly, you know, he had a desire, he had a fundamental trust question, which is always a problem with him. He had a he thought that he had made a giant deal with the California Teachers Association on education funding. It was a deal that was very useful to him in his first year, gave him a little pressure on the budget side of things. But then he decided he would essentially break the deal, though he managed to convince himself that he hadn't broken it. This is very complicated. It goes to this unique funding formula, Prop 98, that we have. But he essentially broke the deal and would never acknowledge that he'd broke the deal, that he'd really sort of changed his mind. And so instead of creating a public debate about reform in California and these issues that were, you know, important issues, redistricting and pensions and how the budget is structured and some education policy, what happened is he created a giant public debate about himself, his own trustworthiness, and his own commitment to education. And he got into that debate with the California Teachers Association, the most politically sophisticated, interest group in the state, and a group with which he had worked that knew him well and had a sense of how to beat him from their time working together early on the budget and also with Prop 49, his after-school measure. So he tried to salvage things. And he spent most of 2005 trying to find a deal, some way out of this giant election that he had started. Now, he knew there was going to be an election. By June, he'd actually set a date for it. But again, he wanted compromise ballot measures, which would replace these initiatives, which he had a good idea were going to lose if they went all the way to the ballot. And the deal he wanted was a big deal, a global deal, something that dealt with all of the different subjects of his initiatives. But also other, you know, other key issues in the state. You know, health care was one. And so he began a series of secret negotiations with unions and Democratic legislators to try to make this happen. The first round was with the CTA itself in May of 2005. They met in very scattered places around Sacramento, but not near the Capitol, so they wouldn't be detected. Those ultimately failed. The second was with with key staffers from his shop and from the shops of the leader of the Democratic leader of the Senate, Don Parada, and Assembly Speaker Fabian Nunez. He was convinced that these were going to work. At one point, they actually drafted compromise ballot measures that would replace the initiatives. But ultimately, personality became part of it, and a lot of Schwarzenegger's staff, who were deeply suspicious of the Democratic staff, decided that this thing wasn't for real, that they were just trying to, you know, Democrats were just trying to hold up and pretend to negotiate so they would keep Schwarzenegger off the campaign trail for his initiatives. When those talks failed, he became very angry at his staff and never really trusted his staff again. That's the first staff. There will be a big turnover. So he cut out his staff, and in August of 2005, he invited the Speaker of the Assembly, Fabian Nunez, to his home in Brentwood. Nunez brought a staffer. Schwarzenegger didn't. Schwarzenegger negotiated by himself, trusting essentially himself, only himself. And they got pretty close. They sat down and they charted all the different issues they wanted to deal with and what Schwarzenegger and Speaker Nunez came to call the enchilada deal, because this was going to deal with the whole enchilada of issues before the state. And Bob Hertzberg came in, the former Assembly Speaker, Democrat. Arnold brought him in as essentially a mediator in these enchilada talks. The public employees unions tried to talk Nunez from going into these talks. When Schwarzenegger's own staff found out about them, they tried to sabotage the talks. But they worked, and this document that they produced, a chart of a possible compromise, which was titled The Roadmap to Peace in Our Time, is a pretty extraordinary document, which I managed to get my hands on. It includes some of Schwarzenegger's own handwritten notes from these talks. And they dealt with every issue. They talked about dealing with pensions through a bipartisan commission, dealt with a couple of education issues related to teachers and how teachers are, become qualified to work and how they're trained. Healthcare was part of it. A number of political reform issues, including redistricting and campaign finance and term limits, were part of it. There were even discussions, though it's not clear that they had ever had an agreement. They discussed changing Prop 98, the education funding formula, which effectively governs half of California's budget. And Schwarzenegger's willing to give on the central requirement out of Prop 13, which requires a two-thirds vote for tax increases in the budget. He was willing to reduce that. That's a big deal. But they ran out of time. There was a deadline of August 18th. It was originally August 15th, later August 18th to get this thing on the ballot. There was, again, this push and pull from Schwarzenegger's staff and from some of the Democratic interest groups. His staff nearly revolted when they learned about it. Two senior members of his staff even tried to leak damaging information about their boss to a newspaper at that point. That's how angry his people were at him. They cut him out. But they didn't get the deal, and he saw this failure as the real defeat. I mean, the election that came 3 months later where he lost the initiatives, that wasn't the real defeat. This was the real nadir, and that was the moment where he and his wife began to work and really look full-time at replacing their staff and bringing in new people. That's when he felt he lost. But because he didn't get this deal, he's never sort of given up on it. He hasn't changed his goals. He still wants a second enchilada deal, and that's what he sees his second term as being about, getting another bite at the enchilada. Last year, actually late 05, after he lost, he sat down again with Nunez, asked Nunez's advice about what he should improve in himself as a governor, in his staff, and then he tried to look at the issues that were most important to Nunez, parts of his agenda, and then try to pick spots, particular things, particular pieces of legislation that, you know, he felt like he could make a deal on that he could live with. And those became some of the deals you saw last year with minimum wage, with prescription drug policy. And that became, you know, both sort of his way to try to get back into the game of building up to an enchilada deal and also to win re-election, so you would have the chance to do that. He's still working on that enchilada deal, and he's again going at it very differently, much less confrontational. There are no initiatives being threatened, except sort of on the redistricting piece. He's picked healthcare first, an issue where Nunez and Prada are very interested in making changes. The idea is if you can do something big like that, you gain momentum, you can go on to prison reform, you can change water policy, both very difficult subjects, and you create this sort of, you know, warm and fuzzy packaging, a kind of zone of cooperation, so you can come back on the difficult issues that were on the ballot in the special election. You do something to deal with pension costs. You deal something to do with how the districts are drawn, the redistricting issue. You go look at education reform and education funding, and you look at the structure of the budget. But once again, he's trying to do this piece by piece, to be a little more patient. Patience is very difficult for this man. But that's essentially the approach. He's delegated more authority to his new staff. Susan Kennedy is his new chief of staff. She's a Democrat, worked for Gray Davis. And certainly he's given her more authority, longtime aides of his say, than they've ever seen him give anyone before. But he's still very much in charge, and he's holding very little back. His speeches show that. The State of the State speech in the inaugural, which sort of almost poked his finger in the eye of Republicans and of partisans, because we're post-partisan, really show that. And he is talking in a kind of messianic way that I think previous speech writers have tried to tone down, about making us this great model to the rest of the country and the rest of the world, that we can show how to get along and solve difficult problems. It's a bit much, but that seems to be the direction we're going. Now, a bottom line question, I'm almost done here. Thank you for your patience. Will it work? 3 points on that. I'm not an optimist, and that's, I think, because the launch of this push for, you know, another big enchilada deal, piece by piece, faces many of the same problems that he faced when he pursued reform in 2005, big reforms, which was the year of the special election. There's a point one is sort of the special election deja vu of this. When he went into that election, and pushed on reforms. At the same time, he was breaking that deal with the education community, with the teachers union, where he had promised a certain level of funding and didn't deliver it in the time that he had promised. And of course, that became the dominant argument. Has he broken this promise that he made to the children? A very simple kind of he's a liar, he's not a liar sort of argument that overwhelmed the airwaves and prevented him from getting to a debate, a much more complicated and complex debate about finding a solution for all these problems, talking about the need for reform in the state. Something is happening right now that's very similar. His health care plan has really surprised his conservative supporters because it includes an employer mandate, a 4% assessment on payroll. And there's already a debate. Is this a fee or is this a tax? And to the extent that it's being called a tax very broadly, and he has made this sort of ironclad promise to conservatives, one of the few things he's given Republicans is this notion that there will be no new taxes. He gets into the same kind of debate. Did he lie? Did he break his word on taxes? Rather than getting into debate that he needs to have about, you know, the particulars of this health, of our health care crisis, how to deal with it, that back and forth, the kind of the debate that can actually fuel getting legislation that's ultimately meaningful. That's problem number one, point number one. Point number two is that, you know, his fetishness on doing something that's always big and comprehensive and bigger than anyone has done before means that he is essentially, as he did in 2005, taking on a huge number of interest groups and creating the potential for interest groups to unite against him. You saw the different kinds of unions unite against him. Well, here you've got doctors, small business, insurance companies, all powerful lobbies who are offended by different parts of this proposal. You're already seeing some signs. There are already actually a few television ads on the air funded by a group that does not disclose its funding, but I suspect includes representatives of all those interests. And by, you know, by uniting your enemies, you create tremendous problems for each other. This plan was, it's Thursday, this plan was introduced on Monday. So, you know, already there's trouble there. And I think ultimately there will be, because he's talked about something so big and introduced something so fairly comprehensive, there will be a temptation to ultimately pass something that feels very big, that can be sold as a big thing, but isn't very big. In healthcare, what that looks like, it may be, is passing legislation that will be represented as saying, we're covering all children. Though, of course, the issue of whether the children are the immigrant status of the children will become an issue of that. But there's some question about how much that would really advance the ball. We already in this state provide health care to health insurance for a lot of children. And one of the issues we continue to have is finding all the folks who are eligible and enrolling them. That's both a funding issue, but it's also sort of an outreach issue, and in some ways a cultural issue. So that's the other problem, point two. And then point three is the sort of live by direct democracy, die by direct democracy dynamic that I think is about to emerge. Here's a person who was elected in a recall, introduced himself to the public via initiative, Prop 49, the after-school initiative of 2002. But he's now very vulnerable. This sort of deal-making style, this emphasis on the big deal. Big deals are exactly the kind of pieces of legislation that draw referenda, where, you know, signatures are gathered and you try to reverse a bit of legislation. The last big major healthcare legislation in the state, SB2, which was an employer mandate, different than the one that he is proposing, but still in the same ballpark, was actually overturned by the voters in a referendum in 2004. I think this could face a referendum, even if he manages to deal with Nunez and Parada and produce something. He also could find himself under attack via initiative from people on the right, because with this healthcare plan, he's got, you know, he's vulnerable now on the tax issue. He's also vulnerable on the immigration issue. Both those issues are the kind of hot buttons that sometimes make politically successful initiatives. There's, you know, myriad possibilities of things that could be run against him. A third point under this point, the other thing he's attractive as, and this is a notion of mine that no one has yet adopted, but I think he's uniquely attractive as a target for a recall. Why? Well, he's famous. And it's pretty cheap to qualify a recall. We had very low turnout in our last election. And remember, these ballot measures, to qualify them, they're signature percentages, 5% or 8% or 12% of the number of people who voted in the last gubernatorial election. A low turnout election like the one we had this past fall means that the number of signatures you have to actually have to gather for recall is fewer than a million. It's pretty cheap. You could probably do it for $2 million. And because this fellow is world famous, you can probably buy 100 times that in worldwide publicity for putting your $2 million down to the recall, because you're famous all over the world. You're on television and papers all over the world as the guy trying to recall Arnold Schwarzenegger. In our state, 37 million strong, has lots of people with money and lots of people who have a desperate desire to get attention. I would say it's a sort of marketing opportunity staring us in the face. But a thought. I don't know that a recall would possibly pass, but it's very easy to qualify one and get one in the ballot, and it would certainly be a political distraction and hurt the momentum that's required for this approach he has, you know, deal building on deal. The other thing is the rhythm of the state is that we seem to have odd year popular revolts. In 2003, we had a kind of a revolt that started in the right and spread to the center. That was the recall against Davis. I think in 2005, we had a counter revolt starting from the left and spreading to the center against Arnold because some of these proposals. And again, with this healthcare thing, you bring together these hot button issues on the right of taxes and immigration. And the healthcare proposal of his binds these to bring these two issues together, and you have something that's really could really catch fire. So finally, I mean, essentially, the governor's direction, I think, and views on this have been clear in terms of what he's are actually never been clearer than they are now in terms of what he's trying to do. I think what's not clear is what the rest of the actors, including us, are going to do. Are the interest groups and are the public willing to get behind this sort of governor with a grandiose vision and try to reach compromises and big problems and really support them? I mean, you have a governor who is so hungry for the whole enchilada that he's really willing to help others participate deeply in making the meal. And then the question becomes, if we do get some changes, if we do get legislation, will we hold them to account for the making big changes? Are we going to just sort of get centrist deals that are kind of wallpaper on problems? Or will we get, you know, really, you know, hard changes that you know, that really change the reality of the state? I mean, I think the question fundamentally is, you know, is his middle soft? Anyway, I will stop there. Not much to be speech maker, but thank you very much for listening to me. And I would be open to any and all questions. Anyone at all?
Yeah. I'll start out with one. I have an impression, I'd be interested in your perspective, that when he first came into office, he was very much beholden to the Pete Wilson machine and had some kind of a close political relationship. What's the state of their relationship now?
I think that relationship has always been, that's a great question. I think that relationship continues with Wilson personally. I mean, it was a lot of Wilson's people who got him to, you know, provided they were the consultants and the pollsters that got him to the starting line in terms of deciding to run. Once he decided to run and started, I think there was some expectation among those people that they would be able to control him, and they became immediately frustrated and never got over their frustration that they couldn't control him, just simply because he's an uncontrollable person. I mean, it took them quite some time before he did most of his own scheduling, kept his own calendar, I mean, which is, you know, pretty amazing for a guy who's that big a deal. And they never really got him to even sort of let them schedule him. That's how difficult he was to control. I think Wilson and he continue to talk. I talked extensively to Wilson for this book, and we were able to document all those conversations. And Wilson was pretty upfront about telling him, you know, essentially over and over again, you're not being tough enough, get tougher with the unions, seems to have been the Wilson message throughout. And I think, you know, it continues to this day, and Schwarzenegger has at times been tougher than the unions, obviously, and at times not. keeps listening to him. But I think he also has, and this is more of a new phenomenon, though not that new, I think he was talking to him 6 months in, and that's the relationship with Governor Davis. They clearly talk. You know, I think his two most significant aides, Susan Kenney as chief of staff, and Daniel Zingali, who is Maria's chief of staff, but is actually now has the title of senior advisor to the governor, and is really the top policy thinker. He comes out of the Clinton administration in there, are really the two most important people, and both of them work for Davis. So that's, there. I mean, he draws on everything. I mean, it's an incredible array from when he was doing workers' comp, he would call anyone from Warren Buffett to talk about the reinsurance market and how that would affect rates to this guy, Kenny, who manages his fleet of vehicles out of his body shop in Beverly Hills. And each of them were, asked a lot of questions of each, and I think took the answers seriously.
Two questions. One was, why didn't he run originally without the recall? We have a feeling maybe he was a coward in that respect, that he didn't want to reach out originally as a candidate against whoever in the Democratic Party. And the second one was, after this defeat of all of his initiatives, yeah, how much did he listen to the Kennedys, who are people more likely to have been in support of those resolutions? In fact, you did mention, and you keep bringing in Maria Shriver, who is a Kennedy and probably is well versed in Democratic kind of generosities that we think of. So I just wondered how much of these two things are in his personality, and that this being the great I say Terminator, is that what he's called?
Right.
I wonder how much these have been his part of his personality.
Those are really great questions and insightful. The first one, did he think about running, in the regular election, which he did. I think his plan was to eventually became to run in 2006. Once Davis would have been out of office, that was essentially what he settled on. He did think about a lot seriously, and that authenticity interview I talked about happened in 2001 when he was thinking about running in 2002 against Davis when Davis was running for re-election. And there were a lot of things happened there. He was actually some of his sex life came out in the tabloids. Some writers have said that was a big factor. I actually don't think it is. He's so used to that kind of thing that I never got the impression that it bothers him. When I asked him about some of his behavior that we reported in our paper towards of women, he never disputed. In fact, said he was wrong and felt pretty embarrassed about it. I never got the sense that that was a factor. The bigger factor was the movie Terminator 3. And what that provided, which was a way to go out and top in Hollywood, but also the money. The contract he was offered was incredible. It started with about $31 million up front, and with all the ancillaries, he's still making money on it. He's gotten more than $50 million from it, and he very much saw that money, including memos that were inside his office, clear. He saw that money as a political nest egg, a way to have a bunch of cash while going into politics that he could thus spend on whatever his political needs were, getting elected and ultimately, running a lot of initiatives as he did. He spent almost more than $30 million of that money already between all the various initiatives. And Terminator 3 is a very much a political document. He had control over the script. You notice he kills no living thing in that movie. In the first Terminator, he actually shoots up a Los Angeles police station, which wouldn't have been very gubernatorial. So that, if that answers that first question. The second is, how much did he listen to the Kennedys? He listened to a lot after the defeat, but he always listens to them a lot. His wife is obviously no wallflower, and he really listens to his mother-in-law. His mother-in-law was actually advising him during the special election. That was the time where I was spending the most time with him because I was on book leave and I did not have to file daily for the Times. And I heard his mother-in-law, his mother-in-law came out to help him campaign. She was calling him. I heard, sort of heard his side of the conversation where she was haranguing him for not, talking enough about what he was doing. There was a big argument whether he should be talking more about himself or more about the initiatives, and she was on the more about yourself side of that argument. His mother-in-law is the reason without her, he would not be in politics. She's been his biggest fan. She's been telling him for 20 years, you know, you can do this, you're natural in this, you know, you're, you know, I saw my brother Jack, and you're, you know, you can do this. His wife did not like this idea, was not saying those things, I think was wishing her mother was not doing that. But, I mean, that was the dynamic. And Eunice is still very much involved. You see her in the office in Sacramento quite a bit, and she lives in D.C.
Hi, Nelson Lichtenstein. I teach labor history. I have a question, which will, to the audience, I should explain. It will seem extremely parochial, but I want to get your view about it, I think. One of the phenomena we've been involved with it in the UC system is a institute for the study of labor and helping unions be more effective. And this is a line item, and it's only a tiny bit of money, $6 million. So it's only symbolic. It is repeatedly blue penciled out of the budget. Nunez and Schwarzenegger will make a deal. I believe you were probably involved with a reportage just yesterday morning and for this morning's article. They'll make a deal, and then the thing will be blue penciled out, and then the left and the unions and the academics will mobilize and get the thing put back in. I want to know what is going on here, because I want to know what's going on, because it can't, at first we thought it was a mistake. It can't be a mistake. It's happened, I think, three times now. So what's going on?
Okay. Nelson, you all should know, it's very good to see you in the flesh. Usually a disembodied voice on the phone. Nelson is the leading labor historian in this country. And that's a very good question. I think what's happening there, that this last time it may have simply been clerical, this mistake. But he did promise the Speaker of the Assembly last year that this budget item would stay in and wouldn't be zeroed out. The Republicans like to play a game where they zero out these labor institutes and then make, you know, the Democrats put them back in, and there's always a price. You know, if you're going to put that money back in, they get something. So it's a nice negotiating tactic. That's been the dynamic. This time, I know this from both sides, there was a deal that they wouldn't play this game. There would be permanent funding of this thing. But the way I reported it down, and I only have 24 hours of reporting on this, was that when that deal was made, and this tells you about Schwarzenegger being kind of a lone wolf with his staff, is that it was him and the speaker in the room doing it. And Schwarzenegger is not a particularly good communicator to his own staff. So it seems to me possible that he made this deal, fully intended to keep it, and never fully communicated it to anybody.
Schwarzenegger vetoed the gay marriage bill. What was behind that, and is that consistent with the man you've been describing?
It's a cynical thing, I think. His own four children, he told me, were very angry at him for doing that, as angry at him for doing that as anything he has done in office. This is a guy who's chief of staff, Susan Kennedy, is a lesbian and actually was married in a commitment ceremony in Hawaii with Mr. Zingali. Please don't hold me to this, but I believe serving as the maid of honor in drag. His personal assistant, who is really his friend, a fellow named Clay Russell, who goes with him everywhere, and actually there are two bedrooms in his suite at the Hyatt in Sacramento where he lives. Arnold's in one bedroom, Clay's in the other. Clay wears a wedding ring, as Arnold well knows, sign of his marital commitment to his partner. This guy clearly, he's been to commitment ceremonies. This is not a person who has this. I think it's just something that he did because it would create political problems for him on the right. I think it's purely cynical. I think the other issue on which he's been that cynical is the immigration issue and the driver's license bill, Gil Cedillo's bill, where he actually told Gil Cedillo that, you know, there was a bill that passed in 2003. It was an issue in the recall. Cedillo and the Democrats agreed to repeal it because it would have been referended by the voters almost certainly. But Arnold told them, you know, we'll get a different bill that does the same thing but has a lot of protection so I can sell it, you know, all sorts of checks. And they produced that bill and then Arnold wouldn't sign it. And I think Arnold knows better. I mean, Arnold's essentially personally a liberal on immigration by experience. He's helped all sorts of friends of his over the years get into the country, knows how the system works, knows where the holes are in the system. But, you know, he, those are two things. I mean, I could see him on gay marriage at the end of his time in office doing something on it when there was, when it was sort of too late for anyone to stop him. But, you know, his stated position is that he has no position, that if the public wants to reverse Prop 22, which says marriage is between a man and a woman, it's in the California Constitution, or the courts want to throw it out, he won't stand in the way, he won't appeal the decision. So, I mean, but there it's pretty much cowardice. Anything else?
Hi. Sheila Kuehl, Senate Bill 840, is based on a Lewin Group report that says that if we were to cut out the health insurance middle people and rearrange the way we're already spending dollars coming in for health care, we could cover everybody in the state, here legally or not, and save billions of dollars in the process. And I've been going back and forth a little bit with Jordan Rao.
Oh, yes. The Irreverent Jordan Rao, colleague in Sacramento.
Well, I drop letters that say there's another story on healthcare that doesn't mention the fact that we could save millions or actually billions of dollars with this. Arnold vetoed that. All that bill, I guess, actually called for was for us to look seriously at this idea, and he vetoed that. And now he wants to shuffle the money and spend more of our money and all the paper, not the paper, I can't blame the paper, but they we hear is why covering all those people is going to cost millions of dollars. And yes, it is, and we're already spending millions of dollars. Why did Arnold veto it? What can we do to get him to change his mind?
Well, I think, you know, again, I mean, I explained his philosophy, and it's not a sophisticated one, but you know, if you can convince him that it has the taint of socialism, you're going to have an issue. But I think part of the reason why that went down and probably didn't get a lot of consideration was that it wasn't time. He knew he was going to do something big this year, and I think you could get a lot of the elements in it ultimately into legislation this year, but it's not time. You know, it's time for healthcare when Arnold says it's time. It's very much, you know, his desire to control things and to set the stage and have a big stage, big process like we're going to have. And I think with him, you know, there are a couple things. If I were negotiating with him, I would just keep pushing. I would keep making my arguments and trying to do it in his presence because he can be moved by a good argument. He clearly can change his mind. And then the other thing is, you know, when you get the deal, God, please get it in writing. I mean, you know, get it written down. I mean, the CTA almost didn't get it in writing on the education deal. A consultant for them named John Mockler insisted they reduce some of this stuff for writing, and it was useful because ultimately they had to sue him over that broken education deal. I mean, he's someone, wonderful guy, fun to be around, you know, wants to make people feel good when he's negotiating, but really he's definitely someone, you know, who you got to get it in writing. But I think pushing will work. I mean, he does respond to pressure, and he's interested. If someone's got a really strong point and it's different than his, and you can get in within his hearing, he's going to be drawn to you. He's going to want to find out what that's about. So I don't think that's over.
It's just really interesting I feel that he has gone from trying to align himself with the right and obviously failing at that, and now seems to be, as you say, going to a series of beliefs that are very core to him, and he seems to be really throwing his personality into his message in a way that's not happened before. My personal feeling is that he's picked up two really big issues in healthcare and in you know, green philosophy for California that seem to be almost blockbuster quality from what the country wants at this point. Do you think he has a capability of really coming through on those in a blockbuster way?
You know, I'd love to answer yes, but I'm just so skeptical. I mean, he's such a great salesman and promoter and pusher of ideas and creator of dramas, but I mean, when you look at his record, for all of the noise he has made, when you look at the bottom line, how has he changed the law? How has he really changed the underlying dynamics and the structure of California? I don't think there's a lot there. I don't think there's a lot on the ledger of actual accomplishment. I mean, tweak the workers' comp system so things are, you know, better for insurers, a little bit better for small business, and not so good for some people who have a, you know, certain kinds of permanent disabilities. I mean, that was a big change. I think he has done some things in local government finance that really changed things. But I think on those issues, I mean, he wants to do something big because of his own ego and his sense of himself as a historic figure. And he's smart. I mean, he understands and gets into these policy details. But he's so, his desire to do something big and to sell the big thing is such that I can see him making deals that are easier, that look big, but don't really, you know, make big changes, or the change is more symbolic. And sometimes I think that's really what he has to be judged on, the sort of, it's not a left-right continuum. It's sort of a selflessness, selfishness continuum with him. That's what people really ought to look for, is just, you know, kind of how real these things turn out to be.
You've been listening to a podcast from University of California Television. For more information about this and other UCTV programs, visit us online at www.uctv.tv.